If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today's show features Seth's conversation with director Edgar Wright, whose new movie Baby Driver just hit theaters. Edgar then takes a few more questions backstage just for this podcast. But first, let's hear Seth take a closer look.
Republicans are frantically working behind closed doors to win over enough votes for their health care bill in the Senate, giving themselves a deadline of tomorrow to get a deal done. But there's at least one big thing making that difficult: the fact that the president doesn't seem to know anything about health care. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Donald Trump's first 5 months in office have been mostly a series of setbacks, from record low approval ratings to a rapidly escalating special counsel investigation to the unraveling of his signature health care bill. But that hasn't stopped him from already looking forward to 2020 and benefiting himself financially in the process.
President Donald Trump is kicking off his 2020 re-election fundraising. Last night, he held an event at his Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C.
It's conflict of interest in terms of the money's going to his company.
He has not yet hit the six-month mark of his presidency, and now the first big hotel ballroom kind of fundraiser to, as our Jeff Zeleny was reporting, to according to Republican sources, to ward off a potential primary challenger, at least say, hey, I'm not going anywhere.
You know things are bad when 5 months into your presidency, you have to tell people, hey, I'm not going anywhere. That's like hearing a couple is renewing their vows a month after the wedding. It's like, ooh, who cheated on who? Also, how much more obvious can Trump be about the fact that he's scamming us? He's holding a high-dollar fundraiser at his own hotel. When he does leave office, he's definitely stealing stuff from the White House.
What, this? No, I brought this with me. This is my bust of Abraham Lincoln.
So Trump is already focused on 2020, and I guess in a way it makes sense because he loves running for president, but he hates being president. And the reason he hates it is it's hard, as evidenced by the fact that the signature legislation of his presidency so far, the GOP health care bill, is one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation in recent history. In fact, multiple polls have come out this week on the Senate bill, and each one somehow manages to be even worse than the last.
NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. Overall, 17% of Americans support the Senate Republican plan.
The polling out today on this bill is absolutely terrible for Republicans. 16% of Americans, according to Quinnipiac.
A USA Today poll, 12% approval of this bill from the Senate.
12%. His health care bill is an iPhone in a horror movie. It's going to hit zero, and everyone is going to die. The bill is so unpopular that Trump is now at the point where he's promising a twist ending. Trump met with the World Series champion Cubs at the White House yesterday, and for some reason, he felt the need to interrupt those festivities and make a vague announcement about the health care bill.
And just to do a little official business, health care is working along very well. We could have a big surprise with a great health care package, so now they're happy.
What do you mean by a big surprise, sir?
I think you're going to have a great, great surprise.
It's going to be great. Thank you very much.
Because that's what you want when it comes to healthcare. Surprises. Surprise! guys, that's not your x-ray. This is your x-ray. And yes, that's a sponge I left in there. Double surprise. But if the Cubs found themselves in the unenviable position of standing awkwardly next to Trump while he rambled on about health care, they maybe should have taken their cues from Cubs pitcher Carl Edwards Jr., who skipped the meeting. Asked what he would do in D.C. instead of meeting the president, Edwards says, I'm trying to go see, like, the Dinosaur Museum. So apparently, he went to the Senate. Woo! Oh. The Grumposaurus. Now, you may be asking, how did the GOP healthcare bill get so unpopular? Well, aside from the actual real-world consequences, which would be devastating for millions of people, there's also the fact that the president himself, the most visible supporter of the bill, has never been able to articulate a convincing case for it. Now, he's very clear on how he feels about Obamacare. It's a disaster. We need to repeal it. But every time Trump talks about his bill, he uses the vaguest terms possible and seems at a loss to describe what any of it actually means. Here's Trump yesterday at a roundtable event at the White House. Listen to the utter lack of actual details.
We're talking about a great, great form of health care. We are looking at a health care that would be a fantastic tribute to our country, a health care that will take care of people finally for the right reasons and also at the right cost. And what also came out is the fact that this health care would be so good, would be far better than Obamacare, and would be much less expensive for the people, and actually much less expensive also for the country. So those are a lot of good factors. I think this has a chance to be a great health care.
He sounds like a high school student who didn't read the book or have the book or know how to read. In fact, Trump ally, Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, admitted yesterday that Trump is incapable of grasping the policy details, saying someone else should come up with an argument in favor of the GOP health care bill and then explain it to Trump. Gingrich told the AP, Trump will be able to repeat it with enormous effectiveness once somebody translates it. Great. You know, just make sure that if you let him out of his cage, all the windows are closed. In fact, as Trump has started to get more involved in the health care negotiations, more reports have started to leak about just how little Trump understands about the issue of health care and the specifics of the GOP bill.
According to the Weekly Standard, several senators who have spoken with the president about the legislation describe an executive with little apparent understanding of the basic principles of the reforms and virtually no understanding of the details. The Washington Post reports that in private conversations on Capitol Hill, the president is often not taken seriously.
Oh, really? Congress doesn't take Trump seriously? I wonder why.
I'm president. Can you believe it?
No. No. They can't. Just take one basic detail of the bill, which is that it repeals most of Obamacare's taxes, resulting in more than $600 billion in tax breaks, mostly for wealthy families. Senators apparently raised that issue during a White House meeting with Trump this week, but according to the senators who were present at the meeting, Trump seemed to have no idea what they were talking about.
A senator who supports the bill left the meeting at the White House with a sense that the president did not have a grasp of some basic elements of the Senate plan.
Watching this president try to negotiate a complex piece of legislation is like playing Call of Duty with your grandmother. Which one is me? Why can't I go that way? Oh, no, they're shooting at us. Trump apparently did not like that story because he lashed out at the Times on Twitter, writing, some of the fake news media likes to say that I am not totally engaged in healthcare. Wrong. I know the subject well and want victory for U.S. If you know the subject well, you'd know the goal isn't victory, it's good healthcare. I know baseball very well and want many touchdowns for our team. Also, anytime Trump shouts or says wrong, it's a classic tell that what he's being accused of is accurate. Remember,
Donald supported the invasion of Iraq.
Wrong.
That is absolutely
wrong.
Proved over and over again.
Wrong. The action.
He leaned into the mic like he was calling someone's number at KFC.
Number 52, 12 piece. Extra crispy. Oh, wait, that's mine. I ordered that.
In fact, Trump is so in the dark about the actual details of the health care bill that when he meets with GOP senators, he's apparently adopted the tack of just agreeing with everyone, even if they want drastically different things. For example, there are conservatives like Rand Paul who want the bill to go further in rolling back Obamacare, and moderates like Susan Collins, who wanted to be more generous. And yet, as Politico reports, both left this week's Obamacare repeal meetings with Trump, thinking he's on their side. Trump spoke for only about 10 minutes, and when he talked, he seemed to agree with everyone there. One source told Politico he runs a good meeting, but he doesn't know anything. It was like a CEO with his subordinates. No, it wasn't. He's less like a CEO and more like a mall Santa. A bike? Sure. Train set? No problem. I'm not real. You guessed it. But it isn't just the fact that Trump doesn't know anything that has made this bill so unpopular. There's also the fact that it betrays virtually everything he campaigned on. It is quite literally a massive tax cut for the wealthy, paid for by taking health care away from millions of people. Just to put in real terms how backwards this bill is, households with incomes above $1 million a year would get annual tax cuts averaging more than $50,000 apiece, worth more than the cost of continuing Medicaid expansion coverage for 8 people. Just think about that. Just to give one household a $50,000 tax cut, you have to kick 8 people off Medicaid. That's just, well, what's the word?
Wrong.
This health care bill is cruel and vicious, which shouldn't be surprising because it is coming from a president who is cruel and vicious, as evidenced by his tweets today attacking Morning Joe's Mika Brzezinski. Trump, an old-school misogynist, tweeted that Joe and Mika came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me. She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. Said no to what? Your meds? Trump's Twitter rants have gone from confusing... It's so confusing now. His Twitter rants have gone from confusing to, Mommy, why is the man on the subway yelling so loud and where are his underpants? Yet Republican leadership continues to put up with it because if they do, they could trade your health care for tax cuts. To the likes of Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump's presidency is a filet mignon steak with a little piece of on it. And they're willing to ignore that to get the steak, but it's become clear that it's actually a giant piece of with a little bit of steak on it. And their attitude seems to be, well, we're already at the restaurant. This has been a closer look.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at iTunes.com/LateNightSeth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
Is the talented filmmaker behind Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. His latest film is Baby Driver, which is in theaters now. Please welcome to the show, Edgar Wright, everybody. Welcome, Edgar.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on this film. It's fantastic. And this is about a guy who is a getaway driver. He plans his getaway drives to specific songs.
Yeah.
And this is an idea you had back in your early 20s?
Yeah, it was basically, when I heard the song that was in that clip, actually, by the John Spencer Blues Explosion, I heard that when I was 21, and it's not like I necessarily thought, like, oh, this is a movie. I literally couldn't listen to the song without thinking of a car chase. So it was like kind of my version of action movie synesthesia. It was like, oh, this song is a car chase. And then eventually I had to come up with the movie that went with that song, which has been, you know, a process over, like, 22 years.
It must have been so fun to pick all these songs that are getaway songs.
Yes.
I mean, it's fantastic. The soundtrack alone is sort of one of the co-stars of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing is that you, I mean, I like, there's that thing of, like, a lot of people have, like, oh, this is a great driving song. And I tend to think one further in terms of this is a great car chase song. This is a great foot chase song. This is a great kind of ramming into other cars kind of song. So it's just like this. I've just, like, got, like, I mean, a bit like Rain Man, just got endless playlists of, like, different songs for different scenes.
Different chases.
Yeah.
Now, there was no green screen in this film, which happens in, I think, most films where you have these kind of car chases. So this was all practical. This was on the Atlanta freeways. I can only imagine how stressful that was to shoot this kind of stuff for real.
Well, the thing is, I mean, people use green screen a lot now just as a sort of practicality thing. It's easier to do the actor shots on green screen. So it's not just doing the stunt car stuff on the roads, but shooting all the actors on the roads. And I remember when I said to the producer that I want to shoot all the actor shots on the freeway as well. They went, okay. And it was like that thing where you're thinking, oh, it's immediately got twice as complicated. But I think it just made it, it's so much more visceral. I think you just feel it. Even in that clip, you can probably see it, that the actors are swinging around sort of corners at like
50
miles an hour.
So you had to get actors of a lot of renown to agree to sort of race around the like Jamie Foxx and John Hamm, and they were cool just saying, yeah, we'll get in the car and get whipped around.
No actor says, oh, no, I don't want to. Whatever they're really thinking, they just do it.
Yeah. Now, did you ever have to ride with the stunt drivers yourself?
I did. Actually, in one of the shots immediately after that, I think the first time we did some shots, it was like a shot of John Bernthal, and we're coming around this corner extremely fast. And even though you know it's going to happen, nothing can really prepare you for it. And I was sitting in the back, and because you were with all the stunt guys and the actors, I think the first take, I, like, whacked my head really hard, and they turned around and said, are you okay again? I go, yeah, yeah, yeah. So you don't want to admit in front of the stunt guys that there's been any pain.
Right. So you're directing the actors when they're in the car. Are you communicating with them via walkies? Like, how are you talking to them?
Well, when you get to doing stuff on the freeway and some of the other, you know, usually, like, it's not like a trailer like it used to be where the car is attached to a trailer. There's this new rig called the Biscuit, named after the film Seabiscuit, because that's what they invented it for. It's basically the car is on, like, its own, like, platform with six wheels, and a stunt driver is on a pod on the outside, like a sidecar. But it does mean that the actors can move around independently at high, high speeds. Now, usually the director is in the van following, watching on a satellite link up. But I felt so distanced being in the van, the command van, that I would say, can I just sit on the car as well with the camera assistants? And it's that thing, you know, when you sort of make a bold decision and then you can't go back from it.
Right.
Like, I want to be strapped in on that car. And then I'm strapped in like Mad Max on the front. And also there's an English person, I'm not really ready for, like, the Georgia weather. We shot it in Atlanta. So I'm, like, sitting there kind of, like, and it's this thing I've, like, made a big thing. It's like, I'm man enough to sit on the car as well. I'm going to get strapped in. I'm watching it on a monitor. And every time that car took off, I was never ready. It's like, hat, walkie. And then also I can see the actors, because it's the one thing that makes it a lot easier is you can... Because, you know, when you're, like, talking over a walkie during a car chase, all, like, sort of articulate direction goes out of the window. And it literally just becomes you screaming, like, intense! Intense, Ansel, intense! But, like, John Hamm saw me, like, struggling outside, and he said this later on, that I thought I was keeping it together, and John Hamm said later that I looked like a floppy, sunburned Muppet. Because every take, I was going... and then everybody goes, are you okay? I go, yeah.
And another thing working against you communication-wise, you mentioned being British for the sunburns, but also car terminology completely different in
England. The biggest lesson learned, people say, what's it like making a film in the States? It's like, it's exactly the same, except on a car movie, it's like hood and trunk, hood and trunk, hood and trunk, not bonnet and boots. Because if you were describing a scene and you say, and then Ansel comes running around the corner and he jumps over the bonnet... And the guys are going, a lady's hat? It's also the British terms are very feminine, bonnets and boots.
Yeah, and it's a very masculine, there's like a lot of thrust behind driving these cars around, and I never thought like, there goes the bonnet.
It would be the other word that would completely lose everybody was shunt, which is like sort of like, so I'd say, oh, and then he shunts into the back of him, and they're like, what? And I'm like saying, I say, what do you call it when you rear-end a car? They say, we call it rear-ending. I was like, they both sound filthy. So I'd like to teach you the word shunt, shunting into the back of somebody.
Well, there you go. Now you have two dirty ways of saying it. congrats on the film. It is fantastic. And thank you so much for being here. It's always great to see you, Edgar. Edgar Wright, everybody. Baby Driver's in theaters now. Make sure you see it.
Hey, everybody, this is Henry. I'm here with Edgar Wright, writer and director of Baby Driver, the fantastic new film. I wanted to ask you, so this movie has incredible action sequences, incredible car chases. You also realistically had a pretty substantial budget to be able to do this. When you were starting out as a filmmaker, how would you kind of improvise when you didn't have the budget you have now with the types of films you'd make?
Oh, when I was a teenager, you would just be trying to find the most lo-fi way of doing something.
Of course, yeah.
So if you didn't have a Steadicam, I used to like make a thing out of, with my old video camera, I made like a cradle with a ceiling tile. I had like a ceiling tile, and I made like a cradle of like sort of string around it, and then I would like hold that. I don't know why I'm miming for this audio podcast.
But it's incredible mime work. If only we could all be here seeing this.
Well, I have to protect my invention, so so it's probably good that people can't see it. But it's basically like a ceiling tile with a piece of string, and that was like my version of a Steadicam, because then it would like I could run along with it and it would float.
That's pretty smart.
I mean, that was the one thing that I did. But most of the time, it's like using, it's sort of seeing what they've done in movies and then figuring out the kind of like the lo-fi way of doing it.
Right. What were the first movies you made when you were a child?
I was, when I was about 14, my parents got me and my brother a secondhand Super 8 camera. Great. And it was one of those presents. You know when you have like a joint birthday present with a sibling? It was like a joint Christmas present and going over two birthdays. So it was essentially like one present covering four events.
Right.
So we had the secondhand Super 8 camera. And I think the first thing that me and my brother did was we had a slow motion function on the Super 8, so we threw all of our toys out of the window in slow motion, put the camera on the ground, and then started throwing sort of our toys towards the camera, just like, and then just the destruction of toys in slow motion. And then I just used to make, because I grew up in the West Country in England, which is a very rural area, and so most of the things I made with my school friends were all like sort of pastiches of genre films.
Yeah.
Because those are the movies I was watching, and I guess there was an aspirational quality to that in terms of, you know, it'd be like westerns, cop movies, superhero movies.
I think a lot of writers feel that way, just like novelists as well, when they kind of will try to imitate voices that they like.
And then because of that, they were also comedies, because it wasn't like I could pull any of them off.
Yeah, right.
I couldn't pull any of them off seriously.
Sure.
So they sort of had to be comedies by default.
Comedy was the crutch.
Yes. I mean, I like comedy. I mean, obviously, I'm a comedy fan as well.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like I couldn't mount a serious Western. It had to be like a silly one.
Right. What's your favorite part of the filmmaking process? Does it change from film to film?
No, I mean, I think it's always like sort of, it's, I mean, it's like, seems dumb to sort of, it's always like, it's fun when it's kind of done. You know, like writing is like tough, and then when it's finished, it's good.
Yeah.
And then it like sort of filming is tough, and then when it's finished, it's good. And
right.
Editing usually is generally the most fun bit because it's coming together at that point.
When you're done editing, you come on a show like this to talk about your movie. I'm wondering, do you like talking about your work?
I do. I mean, especially there was something I'm really proud of the movie. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's only like sort of becomes a lonely process when it's just you being interviewed solo. And at a certain point, you just think, oh, can't you use the answer from the other 300 interviews I did? I said, how did you first get the idea for the movie? And it's like, well. And then it's just when you get over that hump of that well-rehearsed anecdote. And then sometimes if you're doing an interview and somebody asks you a question you've never been asked before, it's like, oh, thank you.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. What's next? What are you working on now? Or is it just kind of you're so focused on getting this film out there?
I am a terrible multitasker. Mm-hmm. And so there's other things that are like sort of in the pipeline.
Yeah.
But whilst this is kind of happening, there's like nothing else.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I can barely think 32 hours into the future. So I have to think of like, oh, I guess I'm going to Los Angeles tomorrow. I guess I should tell people I'm coming home. Like sort of just like sort of, it's very difficult. I find it very difficult to mentally plan ahead.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know? Yeah. Well, the movie's fantastic. I really loved it. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle @LateNightSeth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.